Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 3rd of February, and we have the pleasure to have with us Shagun Kare, with Dr. Chikwe Ikwazu, who is the Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Program. Maybe you want to start by introducing him, Shagun, and just maybe say a word about yourself. I don't know if all the journalists know you. Please.
Hi, good morning. This is only my second time here. I work with WHO Communications, working with the media team, and also focused on emergencies, health emergencies, which is our topic today. I have the pleasure to introduce Dr. Chikwe Ihekwazu, who is WHO's Executive Director of the Health Emergency Program. And he's here to speak today about WHO's health emergency appeal for this new year that we're in, 2026. He's going to speak about the needs in the world that we're seeing today and how WHO is going to respond to them. We will be sharing his remarks as soon as he starts speaking. You'll have them in your inbox with a link to the appeal. And you should also expect a press release at some point. Over to you, Chikwe.
Thank you, Shagun. Good morning, friends, colleagues. A quarter of a billion people are living through humanitarian crisis that strip away the basic protections, safety, shelter, and access to healthcare. In these settings, health needs are surging, whether due to injuries, disease outbreaks, malnutrition, untreated chronic diseases. Yes, access to care is shrinking. Today, WHO is appealing for $1 billion to sustain the essential health services across the world's most severe emergencies in 2026. This money will support the health response in 36 emergencies, including Gaza, the Middle East, Sudan, Ukraine, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, and Myanmar. We are deeply worried about the vast needs and how we will meet them globally. Already, 2025 was an exceptionally difficult year. Global funding cuts forced 6,700 health facilities in 22 humanitarian settings to either close or reduce services, cutting 53 million people off healthcare. Families living on the edge face impossible decisions, such as whether to buy food or to buy medicine. People should never have to make these choices. This is why today we are appealing to the better sense of countries and of people and asking them to invest in a healthier and safer world. When people access care where they live, families stay together and crises are contained. Strong health systems detect threats early, stop outbreaks from escalating, and protect communities across the borders. As we know, diseases do not respect borders, be it cholera, mpox, or any other emerging health threat, as we have seen ourselves over the last couple of years. Last year, the World Health Organization responded to 50 health emergencies in 82 countries, reaching more than 30 million people with essential services. We supported over 8,000 health facilities and deployed more than 1,400 mobile clinics providing healthcare. We coordinated the work of 1,500 partners in humanitarian settings and the deployment of over 100 emergency medical teams who provided 1.8 million health consultations in over 20 countries. And these are not just numbers, these are life-saving interventions that we need around the world, unfortunately. For every emergency responded to, there were many more prevented that, of course, don't make the headlines and shouldn't. Last year, WHO detected and addressed over 450 public health threats through our 24/7 real-time surveillance infrastructure we carry out to keep the world safe. Health is priceless, and yet it is one of the most cost-effective investments that we can make. Today, we again invite the world to invest in health. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chikwe. And let me now go to the questions, if any, in the room. I'll start with Emma Farge, Reuters.
Good morning, Dr. Chikwe. I noticed that this is down from last year's appeal, which I believe was $1.5 billion. Why is that, since the needs seem to be quite great, the way you described them? Can you say how much you actually got last year? And can you explain a bit your thinking around how much to appeal for at a time when you're under a lot of donor pressure to prioritize? Thanks.
So there are several questions in that, and important to, you know, take it step by step. Firstly, you're absolutely right. We're asking for $1 billion last year, this year. Last year, we asked for $1.5 billion. Out of that $1.5 billion, about $900 million was ultimately available for the work that we did around the world. And so this year, that's one of the reasons that we've calibrated our ask a little bit more towards what is available, realistically understanding the situation around the world, the constraints that many countries have. But the other thing is that we too have prioritized our work, and these are not easy decisions to make. We have, we're focusing on those most in need, where we can save the most lives. The term used is called hyper-prioritization. It sounds like a good term, but in effect, we're making some of the hardest choices we have to make. But that's just the reality we face at the moment. So recognizing that the needs haven't really gone down. Unfortunately, they've actually increased. But recognizing as well that the appetite for resource mobilization is much smaller than it was in previous years, we're having to adjust to those realities and ask the world to give us what we think is a realistic amount to do the work that we have to do in some of the hardest contexts around the world.
Robin, AFP.
Good morning. You said you were worried about the vast needs and how you're going to meet them. Can you say a little bit more about what that might entail and how that might shape up over 2026? And secondly, the financial climate in terms of donations from countries, it doesn't look that much different in 2026 from how it looked in 2025. So how will you practically go about trying to get this this $1 billion? Will you be looking to new donors, or will you be tapping hard on the shoulders of existing ones? Thank you.
Thank you. Very important questions you asked. I wished I could report to you that the needs are reducing. This is why our Director General always starts these comments with asking the world to really push harder towards peace, push harder around the conflicts around the world, because, you know, we literally have to pick up the pieces. We very often don't have a direct influence on the course of these challenges, unlike the work we do in the infectious disease space that is more within our gift to intervene on. Work around the humanitarian and conflicts around the world, we pick up the consequences of the conflict. So we continue to advocate in all these contexts for our leaders and the world leaders to really work harder towards peace so that the need for our response in this context reduce. Unfortunately, it's not what we're seeing at the moment, and therefore we are left with these countries and regions in the world where we have to keep intervening, not out of charity, literally, out of global solidarity, and recognizing if we don't do the work that we have to do, we need to do, we will live with even further and deeper consequences that arise from non-intervention. So really, that's why we have set up this appeal. We have adjusted the way we work significantly, using a lot more local partners in the actual implementation of the work in the field. So we work with 1,500 local partners really enabling them to do a lot of the frontline work, but providing them the access, the resources, the commodities, the training, the coordination, the standards that they need to deliver on that work. So really, our role is very unique and very specific in that space. The second question you asked was about how we will go about asking for the resources that we need to do this life-saving work. The process starts today with the appeal that we just launched, just came out of that with our Director General. The immediate response was quite encouraging. Many countries already promised to continue doing giving, strong messages of solidarity to continue. Some even asked, offered to do a little bit more. We will now follow up with each of them on their promises. But definitely, there are many countries around the world that we think can and should do more to support these contexts, recognizing that we all benefit from a more peaceful world. So I don't think the answer is one or the other. We are grateful to all the traditional donors that have supported the work we do, and we'll continue to engage with them. But we really have to reach out to many others that benefit from the work that we do to give a little bit themselves in support and solidarity for those efforts.
Thank you. Catherine?
Yes, good morning, sir. Doctor, could you please give us some names of countries that propose to give even more than they used to do? Thank you.
So beyond fair, Catherine, thank you for the question. I suspected it would come up once I I say that, but I think give us some time. It will be fair. I'm coming exactly from that meeting to this room. So let's follow up on that, see how it evolves. Countries that sometimes speak the loudest don't do the most. So let's manage the situation and give really recognize those that actually put the resources where their mouths are. So give us some time as we evolve the situation and see where the resources come from.
Thank you very much. Emma, you have a follow-up?
If I'm allowed, since it's quite a light agenda today. I was wondering, you've had to scale back a bit. Are you drawing down the appeal sort of across the board, or are there some health emergencies or countries that you're just having to say, we can't do this anymore? And then the second question is, obviously, the U.S. has withdrawn from the organization, but they have in the past given voluntary funding via this WHO emergencies track. So I think it's a different track. Do you still hold some hope that they could still be a donor for the emergencies program? Thanks.
So thanks. Maybe linking back first to the question, the last question. Our traditionally, the top emergency donors last year, just to put the facts on the table, were the EU, Saudi Arabia, Germany, Japan, Italy, UK, the EIB, and the Asia Europe Foundation, in that broad order. Those are the ones we call our traditional donors, and we'll keep going back to them. So actually, for the humanitarian appeal specifically, you'll notice that the US wasn't one of the largest donors. Generally, we've always been supportive and encouraging for the support they've provided. Last year, they provided $29 million for a contingency fund for emergencies, which is a very important, flexible fund that we mobilize for the initial response to any crisis where we're responding to. So grateful for all the support. In terms of how this affects our decisions to respond, every decision to respond, to deploy WHO resources, efforts, is always based on need. It's never based on any geopolitical consideration, unless for some reason we do not have access to that context. But whatever decision we make on where to respond, with what resources, how fast, with whom, depends exactly on our identification of the problem, our assessment of the size and scale of that problem, and the opportunity that we have to respond. In terms of your final question on our anticipation of the US's ultimate decision. I mean, that decision obviously lies with them. Our member states are currently considering this, and this will culminate in the World Health Assembly in May. But, you know, we're a member state organization. Our doors will always be open. It's up to those member states that to decide to stay together, work together in solidarity. The reasons WHO was the reasons our member state came together in the 40s to form the organization are still very valid today, and we suspect and hope that they will continue seeing the value of working in solidarity with each other. And what we provide at here in Geneva and in our offices around the world is the secretariat to enable that. Ultimately, the member states themselves decide what they want from each other and from us.
Thank you very much. Let me go ahead. I don't see a question on the platform. Go ahead, Robin.
Thank you. In recent years, we've seen outbreaks of things like Mpox, Ebola, COVID. If you don't get this £1 billion and it leaves gaps, does it leave the world more vulnerable to epidemics and pandemics?
It absolutely does, and that's exactly the reason why the work we do is so important in identifying these challenges early, responding to them, and managing the future. And one of the outbreaks you mentioned, Mpox, emerged in the 70s, re-emerged in Nigeria in 2017. We did not pay attention sufficiently to it globally. We had a big outbreak that was then declared a public health emergency of international concern, a second one, and we keep working. So these things don't necessarily go away. Our work is consistent. We work on identification, we work on supporting, working with industry, with member states to develop countermeasures, make those countermeasures available, such as vaccines. Mpox is one of the examples where there is a vaccine available that is priced in a way that is unavailable to many countries where it is needed, so it is work in progress. So imagining that these challenges would somehow disappear without global solidarity is wishful thinking. We have a lot of lessons to learn from the COVID pandemic in terms of how to keep building the systems, and WHO has responded by improving our capacities in many different ways. There's a new hub for pandemic and epidemic intelligence in Berlin, a new bio-hub. Many countries are also building their health security infrastructure in so many different countries. I just came back from Japan. They have a new Institute for Health Security. Just met with the delegation from Singapore, have a new public health agency. So both at the national level and at the global level, we're all looking to how to improve, not de-escalate our facilities. So if single countries choose to go in the other direction, the consequences might be not only severe for them, but severe for the world.
We have a question from the New York Times. Nick?
Yeah, good morning. I wonder if I could just press you a little bit more on the casualties of your process of hyper-prioritization. What emergencies are you not dealing with that you would ideally be addressing? We don't see any reference in the list that you gave to Afghanistan and Yemen, for example, which have considerable needs. So could you just get into a little bit more about the casualties of the cuts? Thank you.
So thanks, Nick. Very important question you asked. If you listen to have the opportunity of listening to what I said during the launch of the appeal this morning, you would actually see specific references to the countries that you just mentioned, whether it's Afghanistan or Yemen. So we're very much still working very hard in those contexts. Of course, circumstances are difficult and sometimes access is limited. But we haven't dropped the ball on any of them where we have access to. To be honest, what we have done is in each of those contexts, maybe not done as much as we would like to do. simply because of the resources, the limited resources that we have. So, but broadly, we haven't withdrawn from any crisis. We prioritize them, we push for resources, and sometimes we have more resources to respond to one than the other, and we have to manage within that context. And that's why we also very often ask not only is the amount of resources important, but the flexibility of those resources, so that we can make decisions based only on need. We don't want to make decisions on where to save a life based on who is funding that life to be saved. So one important aspect of the resources that we get is the flexibility of those resources. So the prioritization, the hyper-prioritization just means that within those contexts, we have to really make hard decisions, operational decisions. We never make them from Geneva or from Brazzaville. We leave those decisions to be made by the colleagues working on the ground for them to decide where are the limited resources needed the most. And also, this is what the world expects of us, because we work in this very interesting continuum where we're providing care, but we also hope that in each of those contexts that they are able to develop again, recover, gain resilience, and continue on their developmental journey. So we always have to be careful not to take over completely the provision of healthcare services, because the consequences of that is dependence. So we have to always thread a very thin line of providing care where it is needed the most, make sure that those services are accessible, but also at the same time encourage the continuous development of the people, the resources, the capacities that are often found locally to be ready for the recovery journey. And I hope that that's the intersection that we're able to get to in Gaza, for instance, in the next few months, given the slight ray of hope that we're seeing evolve in that context.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chikwe Yekwatsu. We thank you for coming here on this important day, on this important launch. Good luck, yes, with the follow-up. Thank you for coming, and thank you to Shagun for accompanying you. I think if you have he has to go at 11 o'clock, sorry. But Christian is coming back if you have other questions for WHO afterwards. Thank you very much for coming and briefing the journalist at the UN here in Geneva. We'll now go to our second topic with IFRC. Tommaso has brought us Pierre Kremer, Deputy Regional Director for Africa, please, to tell us about the situation in Sudan and other dire situation. And then if you have more questions for Christian, he'll come back after. Yeah, he'll come back. Bonjour. You want to start? Okay. Okay, so let's thank you very much for being with us, Pierre. Let me start immediately by giving you the floor. I think you're briefing on Sudan this morning.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. So I'm here to mark the point for the 100 days since the escalation of the conflict in El Fasher, and to give you some update about what we know on the consequences of what has happened, because today marks exactly 100 days since the escalation of the conflict, and 100 days of fear and displacement, which followed 500 days of siege of El Fasher. So now it's 100 days in which civilians have paid the highest price. So we as IFRC remain extremely concerned, of course, about this situation. We are not the only one, and especially for the internally displaced people in Sudan, and of course the ongoing conflict in the country, which is certainly the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. And we have seen in El Fasher shocking trauma, shocking violence as well. People have lost loved ones, homes have been destroyed, women raped and families torn apart. A city once full of life has been reduced in a city where people are forced to flee, and often with nothing else but clothes on their back. So that's complete human despair that has been witnessed in Al-Fasher. Many have fled, as you may know, in Tawila, which is at 50 kilometers, but other went to Malit. And we have thousands of people who started this unconceivable journey of 1,000 kilometers to the city of Daba, where we have 20,000 displaced people there. So allow me to share the words of one of them, Fatima, a 35-year-old woman who fled Al-Fasher. So I quote, "We dug tunnels underground to protect ourselves from the shelling. Even at night, we could not use any lights because drones might target us. Food became scarce. People were eating animal food. We ate umbas, which is a residue of peanuts, not for human consumption. And when we left Al-Fasher, we went 4 days without food. We saw people dying from starvation." So that gives you a sense of the horrific situation that these people have been experiencing and facing. And she describes how many documents and valuables were torn from them, and those who could not afford a donkey or a car were forced to walk during this time. So the situation in Al-Fasher today remains catastrophic. Humanitarian operations are largely on hold. As you know, access is extremely constrained in the city. We still have the Sudanese Red Crescent, which is our member, as International Federation of Red Cross Red Crescent, who has been scaling up its response in the displacement site, Tawila, Malit, and Daba especially, and working around the clock since 100 days. So in Tawila, for instance, hosting today 1 million displaced people, we have over 300 Sudanese Red Crescent volunteers providing first aid, psychosocial support, or distributing food. We are working in this Daba camp I mentioned that is 1,000 kilometers from Al-Fasher. So what we observe there is, of course, you know, a situation of daily survival mode. And the families who were torn apart are being helped also to reconnect with their loved one. That's the hardship of displacement. How can I reconnect with family members and those who have no news from for a long time? And these simple tools that mean everything when you're searching someone. But the challenge remains, of course, you know. Fatima, I was quoting just previously, she mentioned to us that she's sharing a one-bedded tent with other families, and they are forced to share blankets. So that's this kind of basic means which are lacking there. So as the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society, we really try to basically to rise to this challenge. We have been trying for a long time. When you ask some of the volunteers, and among the people who fled, some of them became volunteers. And that's a pattern that we have seen in Sudan. Many of the people who are helping others are themselves affected by the crisis for some time. And definitely the key word that come in everyone's mouth is peace, so that everyone can go home. So it's why, from our side, you know, the conflict must end and civilian and humanitarian workers must be protected. That's our main call. You may remember back in October, we had 5 volunteers of the Red Crescent who were killed in line of duties. So out of the 21, actually, volunteers who have been killed since the beginning of the conflict in Sudan. So our message is clear. Humanitarian are not a target. And we must be able to reach those who need it. So access remain one main concern. And an access that has not been easy in Al-Fasher, but again, we are working with volunteers who are coming from the communities. So they are already inside, right? So that's enabled somehow to find solution beyond Al-Fasher in itself. So a last point maybe to speak also about Kordofan. Because what has happened in Al-Fasher may be reproduced to a certain extent in Kordofan. and where we have a deteriorating situation, especially in the south, and a highly volatile environment. And again, we have our Sudanese Red Crescent volunteers who continue to support affected communities where access is possible. But we recognize that many are beyond reach. So we are closely assessing the conditions on the ground for this safe access. And we really call upon the international community to put an end to this ongoing conflict and ensure that humanitarian organizations can do what they exist to do, which is save lives, and but also to restore hope. I would like to finish on that. You know, after 3 years of conflict, almost 3 years of conflict in East Sudan, what people aspire is not only to be the recipient of aid, they also want to be in a condition to lead a productive life as well, and to be able to look at more durable solutions than a constant presence that is a daily hardship. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Pierre Kremer, for these remarks. I see quite a few hands. I'll start from the right. Christiane, the German
press. Thank you very much. Christiane, German press agency. You said that the situation in El Fasha is catastrophic and access is extremely constrained. Does that mean you do have some access? Can you tell us what the Red Crescent, Sudanese Red Crescent, is actually able to do inside, or whether you can get any supplies to be distributed inside El Fasha? Thank you.
All right. We have not been able to go to El Fasher. We still had volunteers there in the city, but in terms of coordination, in terms of basically being able to organize a response, we have not been able to do that. And we are dealing more with the consequences of what has happened in El Fasher, again, in the displaced camps. So that's where our information is and where our focus is as well in terms of humanitarian response.
Thank you very much, Ta-san.
Thank you for the information provided. Are you able to access the besieged area in Kordofan? Do you have any communication with the RSF?
Thank you. Yeah. Now, in Sudan, as you may know, we have a branch in all the 18 provinces, including Kordofan. So that's where the operation can be organized. So so the contact with any armed groups has been managed basically by these branches, because they are coming from the communities we are talking about. They are able to talk with the different de facto authorities if needed, and to ensure this operational continuity, including in Kordofan. But I will not hide that, of course, you know, the information is still quite scarce, and the access is complicated in some areas. Again, we have certainly thousands of people who are beyond reach today in Kordofan as well.
Alicia Gar from Agencia EFE. I would like to know if because you said that in Kordofan the access is limited too. So I wanted to know if the conversation with the authorities there is similar in Kordofan and in Al Fasher, if the access is similar, or what is the response of, or if you have any requirement imposed by the authorities to get access there? Thank you.
Yeah, access need to be negotiated, you're right. And it's true that we still face some challenges, especially when the conflict is especially intense. And in that regard, The main objective for us is also the duty of care for our volunteers, not to be exposed again. I mentioned that we lost 5 volunteers back in October in very difficult situation, where they were presenting their badge of the Red Crescent. So, so that's one area where we try to avoid pushing too much. Of course, we need the protection of volunteers first. We really paid a hard price, and the Sudanese Red Crescent paid a hard price in Sudan. And yeah, it's a sort of daily negotiation on which, you know, it's always complicated to go into details. But yeah, access is an issue. You're right.
So access is complicated, not only because you don't have the allowance from the authorities, but also because there is an ongoing danger because of the attacks.
Is not helping. And again, I'm talking of volunteers who have been themselves already affected by the conflict in their own family. In that regard, in this kind of situation, we have been really trying to ensure this negotiation. And again, we have directors of local branches which are well connected with the groups that can be in Kordofan, and try to negotiate this kind of access, working with the Federation, but also the ICRC, of course, in that regard. And yeah, we try to manage a situation where we have a sort of zero tolerance for additional loss of these people. And again, they are the one who has been on the front line, and sometimes the one who are not so much recognized or promoted the way they should be. They are the one doing the work, basically.
Thank you very much. Any other question for Pierre Kremer online? No, I don't see any. So thank you very much for coming and putting the spotlight on this terrible crisis. Really, we need to hear and continue hearing how the situation evolves. And thank you very much for your work. Oh, I'm sorry. John Zarokossas is asking a question. I don't know if it's for you. John? France 24.
Yes, good morning. It's for Pierre. Thanks very much. Good morning, Pierre. I was wondering if you could bring us up to speed what your national chapters and the IFRC are doing in the crisis in West and Central Africa, especially Northern Nigeria.
So, I mean, in some area where we have armed conflict. So, of course, this national chapter that is, for example, the Nigeria Red Cross is quite active. A little bit the same pattern as we have in Sudan. Again, we have local branches, and we are not enough insisting on the fact that we have this very local response capacity through the national society, very close to the reality, being part of the communities we are talking about, and able to play this kind of mediation role occasionally and to negotiate access. Occasionally, they are the best one to negotiate access, and then we have a basic humanitarian operation in. There, I'm talking about North Nigeria, but it can be also North Benin, for example, where we have movement population as well, ongoing. Of course, we are all facing a sort of funding shortage, but let's say for them, it's not an option. Whether there is money or not, they will be there to stay. They will not be in and out to a certain extent. So I would say it's basic humanitarian action. But in this conflict area, and I mentioned Sudan as well, we should really measure the trauma that it has created, which is a deep trauma, meaning that basically we should have a sort of Marshall Plan for, you know, mental health of this population, because to be in the road of resilience, this need to be really addressed. And the presence of this volunteer is already an agent of resilience in this area. So I'm not so specific, John, but happy to provide more detailed update about what we are doing in this part of Africa.
And I see Tommaso nodding, so they'll get back to you with more details, John. And also for the notes, Pierre's notes.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Merci beaucoup, Pierre. thanks also to Thomas, of course, for coming with Pierre. So that's, I think I haven't forgotten, but I think there were more questions for Christian. Is that the case, Robin, still? Can you come to the podium, Christian?
Hi, Christian. Thanks for jumping in. If you could just give us a few details on the executive board, if you could point us towards any particular things to highlight or look out for during the week. Plus, as well, of course, the when the discussions on Argentina and the USA's notification of withdrawal might come up and what we may expect there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me first use the opportunity to come back to the last briefing we just had. The recordings from this morning's launch, which was at 8:15 at WHO, and the link to the speeches we'll share together with the press release that was mentioned, that's coming out later today. Just so know, whoever's interested in listening to this, when you don't find it on the, if you don't find it on the web yourself, we'll share it later. So, to your questions on the EB. Look, there's a big, a long agenda for this whole week. And maybe even including some night sessions and the annotated agenda. But let me just give a bit of a summary what's coming up these days. So we have, because the political discussions unfortunately seem to be pushing high in the public sphere, but we have actually many, many important topics that the EB, the Executive Board, is tackling. So you have, for example, the reports on the prevention and control of non-communicable diseases, mental health, communicable diseases, universal health coverage, primary health care, substandard and falsified medical products, antimicrobial resistance, and digital health. Among others, all those will be on the agenda. Then the board will also hear reports by the DG on WHO's work in health emergencies, including, of course, to the response in 2025 to 43 health emergencies across 74 countries and territories. Then specific on health conditions in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and WHO's support in the health sector in Ukraine. What else? This EB session also includes discussions on WHO governance reform, the financing and implementation of the program budget that was discussed last week, and updates on human resources, including the prioritization and realignment process that we all went through in last year in 2025. Included also the reform of the global health architecture and the UN80 initiative. So a very loaded agenda. I would not be in a position not wanting to prioritize any of this. They're all really important for the work of the organization. And then the topic you mentioned about the notification by two member states of their intention to withdraw, that has been put on the agenda for Friday. And if you noticed yesterday, I think the chair made a decision to separate those two items, that the item with the two countries, so make two separate items out of them, one on the US, one on Argentina. But that's all we know. Discussion and whether they do it on Friday or pull it earlier or suspend it or take it later, that is entirely up to the member states. But for now, it's on the agenda for Friday and separate issues.
Emma?
Hi, Christian. I just was hoping for an update on medical evacuations from Gaza since Rafah has opened. How many are getting out? What's the number to date? And why isn't it more? And what are your expectations going forward? Thank you.
Always better. So yesterday, on 2nd February, WHO and partners supported the medical evacuation of five patients and seven companions to Egypt via the Rafah crossing. It was the first medical evacuation through this route since sometime in 2025 after that ceasefire. WHO's role focused on ensuring the safe transfer of the patients from Gaza to the Rafah crossing. Yeah, that's that. the process is always a lengthy process, and of course, five patients is fantastic for the five patients, and every single patient who manages to get out is important, given the medical situation in Gaza. But it's always important to note more than 18,500 patients in Gaza still require specialized medical care that is currently not available in the Strip. So 18,500. We managed to get five out, which is, again, fantastic, but obviously we need many more. It's a start of a process there. It was also, as the authorities announced, a test if it works. We all believe it did work so far, and we're hoping this is increasing and turning into really a process where many more of those who need evacuations can actually leave.
Just to follow up, how are you prioritizing, given the extent of the needs? How do you choose who goes? And if you have any details on what the first five were suffering from, that would be helpful. Thank you.
I got cut off again. Thank you, Emma. I do not have details on these five with me, no. But we, WHO, we are not making selection on the patients. The selection is made by the health authorities on the ground. They select, they suggest these patients in a priority list to the security authorities, and then that's the first step, nearly, to get security clearance through Rafa, and then it comes to WHO when we help and organize the transfer and notify the families and so on and so forth. So it's the decision is with authorities on the ground.
Katrine?
Yes, Christian, could you specify the main medical conditions that require the evacuation of those 18,000 people? What are the main reasons?
I would need to speculate. Now, I do not have a list with me here, but that can be all. That can be heavy trauma wounds, of course, resulting from the war. That can be chronic conditions, cancer, diabetes, when severe state where help is not available in Gaza anymore. We know that patients have died basically waiting for evacuation, and that's something which is horrible when you know just a few miles or kilometers outside that border is help available. It used to be available inside, but even if it's only available outside, East Jerusalem, for example, and cannot be reached for political reasons, that's horrible, and people lost their loved ones just for that pure reason.
Please, thank you, Alessandra. What about amputations?
I don't have details with me now, but it depends. If it's a severe amputation which needs medical care because maybe inflammation and serious conditions coming with it, sepsis and what have you, then that could be a reason, but I can't speculate now which is a reason for evacuation. Not, there's certainly a triaging that the authorities are going on, but you can see 18,500 waiting, five managed to get out. Too many stayed behind. That's not just a math, it's a human disaster for those having to wait. But let's not focus now for a moment on those who have still to go out, but let's celebrate the success and hope that we can increase the flow and come back to a continuous evacuation. Hundreds of patients used to go out of the crossing before the conflict on a daily basis, and for a good reason, and we need to come back to that.
And if I may, which countries are willing to accept them? Because we've seen that there's an issue about now about countries accepting them.
That's indeed one of the bigger challenges, or one of the challenges in line. So first the selection, then the security clearance, and then, of course, you need countries to accept. In this case, it was Egypt who accepted, and that's, of course, fantastic. I think also Ireland had a patient coming, but we need more and more countries to step up and help. These are the most vulnerable you can imagine coming out of a conflict like this and in a medical condition that doesn't find any support or any help inside Gaza. We would wish many more countries come forward and help on that front.
I don't see other hands up or on the platform. Thank you very much. Christian, you can stay. Just have a couple of announcements for our journalist. I've been asked to inform you about the upcoming meeting at the CSEG on this Saturday. So the third part of the fifth session of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, what is called as INC 5-3, to develop an international legally binding instrument on plastic pollution, including in the marine environment, will take place this Saturday, 7 February, at the Geneva International Conference Center, CICG. Regional consultations are planned for the morning at the same venue. Following the resignation of the former chair of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, the committee's bureau met on 30th October and agreed to reconvene the fifth session for a one-day in-person meeting to elect a new chair and fill any vice chair vacancies. As this resumed session is procedural and focused on organizational matters, no substantive negotiations will take place on this occasion. The plenary can be watched remotely, as it will be live streamed by our colleagues of UN Web TV or UN TV, and no press briefing is expected following the meetings. If you have any request, you can send it to the UNEP media team at the address that we have distributed. I think you have already heard about this meeting by Alejandro, who can also, of course, being asked for more details. And as I said, that's on Saturday at the CICG. The Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women is reviewing today the report of Vietnam. The other countries they are going to look at is Iraq, Lithuania, Netherlands, Argentina, Czech Republic, El Salvador, and Lesotho. And this morning, the Conference on Disarmament is holding a public plenary meeting, which is the first one under the presidency of Mrs. Dava Surengrenma of Mongolia. And that is what I had for you. If it's not for the fact that tomorrow is International Day of Human Fraternity, we have distributed the speech of the statement of the Secretary General. We really need human fraternity at this moment, so I invite you to have a look at it. Thank you very much. Is there any other question for me or for other colleagues? I don't see any. So thank you very much. Just wanted to say that Matt Bannon from the UNEP is going to come to Geneva a few days earlier. So if you have any question about the meeting at the SEICG, let me know. He will be here in Geneva and will be able to answer your questions. Thank you very much. Have a nice afternoon.